you remember that old commercial, when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen? Well, it's true also of the President of the United States, though with this president, it might be more appropriate to say that when this president tweets, people react. One particular tweet is one we're going to talk about today. It's from last November, in which our then-president-elect Trump said that if people burn the American flag, perhaps they should be sent to jail or maybe even stripped of their citizenship. Lots of First Amendment issues there, so I called Doug McKechnie, our First Amendment guy, and we're going to evaluate Mr. Trump's interesting views on flag burning and put them into context. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's all about flag burning.
It's time for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
On November 29th, 2016, our then-president-elect Donald Trump tweeted, quote, "Nobody should be allowed to burn the American flag. If they do, there must be consequences, perhaps loss of citizenship or year in jail." Well, that caught our attention. It caught lots of people's attention, and it specifically caught the attention of our First Amendment guy, Doug McKechnie, who teaches constitutional law at the U.S. Air Force Academy. And so I decided that Doug and I needed to sit down again and discuss this issue of flag burning and our new president's position on it. Doug always has to say, and so I'll say it for him this time, that his views are his own. They don't necessarily reflect the views of the Air Force or the Department of Defense or the United States government. But that's all preliminary stuff. Let's go straight to the issue. Short answer, would it be constitutional right now, as it stands, to put someone in jail or take away his or her citizenship for the offense of flag burning?
Neither would be constitutional. The answer is no.
Yeah, and pretty clearly unconstitutional.
That's correct.
Okay, good. Well, that's the short answer. So if anyone just wants to turn off the program now and go do something else, we've given you the answer. But let's talk more broadly about flag burning. Let's talk about the First Amendment. And let's talk about any sort of related flag desecration issues that are here, because this is not a new issue, is it?
It's not. And a lot of people, and I think a lot of news outlets, cite to a case from 1989 that established that flag burning for the purposes of communication and protest is protected under the First Amendment. But if you look at the history of flag burning, we have to actually go way back to the mid-19th century, to around 1860, 1870s, to really try to find out where this idea of flag burning and taking offense to flag burning, where that really comes from, and really how that leads up to the case from the 1980s, Texas versus Johnson.
Well, that's a tremendous idea. And this has been before we begin our discussion, and I want to hear all about the 1870s and all the rest of it. We want to emphasize that I can only speak for myself. I personally find flag burning to be very offensive. It upsets me. And you work for the United States Air Force. I'm guessing that it's not one of your favorite things. But we're talking about punishing people legally for doing it. It's not a matter of our personal preference. It's a matter of whether the government should be able to punish people for doing it. And you say those issues were raised as early as the mid-19th century.
They were. It's interesting. If you go back, some of the earliest examples of the government trying to prohibit the mistreatment of the American flag, way back in the 1860s, following the Civil War, there was a military governor of New Orleans who issued a decree that prohibited displaying any symbols representing any authority other than the U.S., and also demanded that U.S. symbols, such as the American flag, would be treated with the utmost deference and respected by all people under pain of severe punishment. So way back following the Civil War, there was a decree that no one would mistreat American symbols, symbols of the United States, including the flag.
That makes so much sense now that you mention it. I'd never thought about this, but right after the Civil War, the Southern states, the Confederacy, had been fighting against the United States. I mean, sometimes we say it was the Confederacy versus the Union, but no, it was a group of seceding states calling themselves the Confederacy that was fighting against the United States government. And they did not like the United States flag, did they?
They didn't. And so when the United States essentially took over the South, or when the North took over the South, one could understand why a military governor might say, you've just been conquered. You were rebelling against the government. And if we find anyone mistreating a symbol of the government, that's going to be met with severe punishment.
And was it?
You know, I'm not sure if there's any evidence of that actually occurring. But what's interesting is, even though that was a reaction by one military governor after the Civil War, Congress itself couldn't even come to a conclusion with regard to whether or not it should ban the misuse of the flag. So about 10 years later, again in the mid-1800s, 1870s, Congress was struggling with whether or not to, and debating whether or not to, ban the use of flag for commercial advertising. It failed to pass that law. And most people point to the fact that the party leaders were concerned that if the law passed, that they wouldn't be able to use the flag in their own political campaigns. So even within the context of trying to pass a law in the 1800s to protect the flag, the United States Congress really couldn't even get its act together to do that.
That's a really interesting question, because on the one hand, if you are genuinely patriotic and you want to fly a flag at your place of business, well, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe most people would find that to be a good thing anyway. On the other hand, I'm just thinking about all the automobile dealerships I drive past that fly these enormous American flags. Are they doing that because the owners are patriotic, or because they're hoping to generate more business by appearing to be patriotic? So the commercial use of the flag does raise an issue, doesn't it?
It does. Well, in fact, that was one of the first cases that the Supreme Court dealt with. The use of the flag was the commercial use of the flag. Mm-hmm. And so in the early 1900s, in 1907, there was a case called Holter versus Nebraska. And Nebraska had a statute that was titled the Act to Prevent and Punish the Desecration of the United States Flag. And this Nebraska law prohibited the use of the flag as part of an advertisement to sell merchandise. And there was a beer producer in Nebraska who made a beer bottle with the American flag on it. So he was charged with the crime. At the time, there was no federal statute protecting the flag. And so he was charged with violating the state law. And he said, wait a second, under the 14th Amendment, I have the right to liberty, life, liberty, and property, and the government can't take that away from me without giving me due process. And so he pointed to the 14th Amendment and not the First Amendment.
And one may ask this, and that this is as good a time as any to point out that as of the early 20th century, the First Amendment only protected us against the national government. And it was, I think, not until about 1925 or so that the First Amendment was first applied to the states. Is that correct?
That's correct. It was the mid-1920s when the Supreme Court applied the First Amendment to the states.
Yeah, I seem to recall it was a case called Weeks. But the point is that the 14th Amendment and that due process clause you've just mentioned was used as a conduit to incorporate, as lawyers like to say, the Bill of Rights piece by piece, including the First Amendment, so to protect us against the state governments as well as the national governments. But this case you're citing now, this commercial case, predated that incorporation in the 1920s. And therefore, this guy was just arguing that the life, liberty, and property aspect of the 14th Amendment's due process clause protected him against this Nebraska statute directly. Is that what his argument was?
Yeah, essentially his argument was the 14th Amendment protects liberty and whatever that means, right? The freedom to do what we want to do. And he said, the 14th Amendment says that I have the liberty to do the things that I want to do, and you're violating my right to liberty, my right to freedom, by telling me I can't use the flag in this manner. And the court said, yes, you know, the 14th Amendment does protect liberty, but the constitutional right to liberty is subject to reasonable restraints. And one of many reasonable restraints is the prohibition on the use of the American flag. The Supreme Court talks a lot about, in this case, about how, you know, flags and banners have long been used by humans to sort of rally around, and the United States is no different. The court says any true American has deep affection and appreciation for the flag, and that states are well within their rights to encourage patriotism. And so the Supreme Court in this 1907 case actually rejects the 14th Amendment argument and says that the state of Nebraska does have the right and can constitutionally punish someone for essentially misusing the flag by putting it on this beer bottle.
That is remarkable. So once again, before the First Amendment protected us from the action of an individual state, this fellow attempted to use the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, its guarantee of liberty, to do the same thing. And the Supreme Court rejected that and said, no, the state does have the power to restrict the commercial use of the flag.
Yeah, the court said, you know, people will not love the country as much. It will diminish the respect for the flag, and that essentially the state has an interest in prohibiting using the flag as an advertisement ploy because it degrades and cheapens the flag. And the court considered this question under the 14th Amendment, but I have no doubt that if the First Amendment was raised or a First Amendment argument was raised, that the court probably would have dismissed that argument as well.
Yeah, the First Amendment itself, putting aside the incorporation issue against the states, the First Amendment itself was not nearly as protective of speech at this time in our history as it subsequently became. So I think that foreshadows where the narrative is going to go next. What did happen next, Doug? After this 1907 case, what was the next great challenge?
There were really two cases in the 30s and the 40s that dealt with flags. Neither one of them really dealt with desecrating the flag. There was a case in the 1930s in California where a person had been flying a red flag, typically red flags being associated with anarchism or communism. And there was a California law that made it a felony to display a red flag as a symbol of opposition to organized government.
Isn't that interesting from a variety of perspectives? I mean, first of all, the very idea that you couldn't fly a flag of some sort is remarkable today. But also how things change, in fact, sometimes by 180 degrees over the span of less than a century. In the early 20th century, the color red was associated with revolutionary communism. And it was the great bugaboo. It was the great opponent of American liberal democracy. And you even had phrases in the 20th century, better dead than red. And then because of a quirk of electronic imagery in the 2000 election, the Republican Party, the more conservative party, the party that had often used such slogans back in the 1950s, happened to be the designated red states in that election of 2000 that went to the Supreme Court, the Bush versus Gore. And so those colors have been locked in. Red has become synonymous with the Republican Party. And so we talk about red states. Now, those are the conservative states.
It is interesting. And it's really, my understanding is that it really all comes down to how they were referred to on a television program that was talking about the election as it was happening.
That's exactly it. I mean, I think that the television networks had a habit of changing those designations, red or blue, from presidential election to presidential election. I mean, I don't recall it having been locked in prior to 2000. But since 2000, the Republican states are always red and the Democratic states are always blue. But going back 100 years, it was exactly the opposite. So I'm sorry, I had to make that observation.
No, it's fine. Well, we know now, way back in the 1930s, the Republicans, they can point to this case to avoid any kind of laws that might prohibit them from waving a red flag in support of the Republican Party. Because what's interesting is the court said flags are a means by which we communicate. And so long as someone's not inciting people to violence, you can fly a red flag or a blue flag or a black flag in opposition to organized government. And it's protecting the American idea that we can communicate our ideas with regard to changing government. And so the court in that case actually protected under the First Amendment. So by this time, the First Amendment had been incorporated and applied to the states. California was prohibited by the Supreme Court from punishing this person for flying this red flag.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week, our topic is flag burning, specifically prompted by that relatively recent tweet by the president-elect about putting people in jail if they burn the American flag. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Doug. So stick around.
You can stand alone with somebody else, or stand with all of us together. If you can believe something bigger than yourself, you can follow the flag forever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's our favorite time of the program. It is, of course, constitutional quiz time. And here with me is the quiz.
Maddie.
No. We have a contestant who's jumping in all over me, but I was actually pausing to look for the quiz pie. Is Doug Smith with us?
The quiz pie is here.
The quiz guy is here with us. And apparently we have a woman on the line with us as well. Who are you, woman?
Maddie from Melbourne, Florida.
Maddie from Melbourne. That's marvelous. Maddie from Melbourne. And are you ready to do a quiz, Maddie from Melbourne?
Yes.
Okay, Doug?
I love Melbourne, right there on the coast.
Yeah, it's a nice place.
It's nice. All right, Maddie, I'm going to give you a question and give you four choices. Are you ready?
Yes.
What important constitutional anniversary happens every December 15th?
December 15th?
What important constitutional anniversary happens every December 15th? Is it A, ratification of the U.S. Constitution?
Oh, the anniversary of when it was ratified? Okay, that's A.
B, ratification of the Constitution of Norway.
Norway?
It's the second oldest constitution on the planet.
But it's Norway.
Yeah. You've got something against Scandinavians?
Not at all. Go on.
All right, here we go. C, ratification of 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution all at once.
Oh, okay. At least we're back in the United States. What's the next choice?
D, the passing of the 28th Amendment, establishing a process for voting in federal elections.
Okay, so once again, what's the question? I got to get this straight.
An important constitutional anniversary, so it happens every year.
Mm-hmm.
On December 15th. Is it A, ratification of the U.S. Constitution, B, ratification of the Constitution of Norway, C, ratification of 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution all at once, or D, the passing of the 28th Amendment?
Maddie?
I'm going to go with C.
C? What was C?
Ratification of 10 amendments all at once to the U.S. Constitution.
Why are you picking C?
Because the Bill of Rights.
Doug, I think she got your number.
Oh, I was trying not to say Bill of Rights.
You were trying not to say Bill of Rights, but we talked about 10 altogether, didn't we?
We did. And it's the only time 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution have ever been passed at one time.
And Maddie knew that, didn't you, Maddie?
I sure did.
You sure did. And in fact, just for bonus, do you know what we call December 15th?
Constitution Day?
It's close, but think about what you just told me. We're celebrating the ratification of
Bill of Rights.
So it's called
Bill of Rights Day.
There, good. Excellent. Yes. Well done. Well done. And bonus now, what state was the last state necessary to ratify the Bill of Rights? Where did this momentous occasion take place? And I'm looking at Doug.
Here's a hint. It's not Rhode Island.
It's definitely not Rhode Island. It's actually Virginia. Virginia, once again, if you had to pick a state to look for all the major points in constitutional history, including this relatively obscure date that most people aren't even aware of, Virginia comes to the fore again. And so every December 15th, we certainly celebrate it around here. And now, Maddie, you're going to be celebrating December 15th as well, aren't you?
I sure am, yep.
Tremendous. Well, thank you, Maddie. Send us an email or a Facebook message or whatever you want to communicate with us. Give us your T-shirt size, and we will stick a T-shirt in the mail to you along with a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, too, and thank you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week our subject is flag burning. It was prompted by then-President-elect Trump's tweet last fall that people who burn the American flag should perhaps be stripped of their citizenship or put in jail. Is that constitutional? Well, our First Amendment guy, Doug McKechnie, doesn't think so. And we're actually going back over a number of cases involving burning flags and displaying flags, even communist flags. Just for the lawyers and the historians in the audience, what was the name of that 1930s red flag case?
Stromberg versus California.
Stromberg versus California. I read that in law school, but I hadn't thought of it in years and years. Okay, great. Fabulous. So then what happened next?
So as a little bit of a break with regard to Supreme Court cases, in 1942, we have the first federal flag code. And this is a federal law that the Congress passed, and it was a uniform guideline for displaying and showing respect to the flag. It did not provide for any penalties. It did not provide for any enforcement mechanism. It was simply a guide, a voluntary guide for how civilians should treat the flag. So that's in 1942, but in 1943, we get a case called West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett.
Before we go leave away from that, the United States flag code is still on the books, isn't it?
It is still on the books. And again, it's sort of a request that people treat the flag in a certain way, and it has certain suggestions on how the flag should be treated, whether it's being raised or lowered, how people should they place their hand on their heart, how do we dispose respectfully of flags, things of that nature.
I learned all about that, or at least I learned about some aspects of it when I was in the Boy Scouts, because we were told very, very specifically, you only display the American flag in a certain fashion. If it's after sundown, you have to have it illuminated. If it starts to rain, you have to take it down. I mean, there were all sorts of things, and many of those are reflected in the flag code, and it's still there. And the reason it's still there is, as you say, it has no penalties. It's really more sort of federal guidance than it is some sort of enforceable law. Okay, so we've got this flag code that's adopted in the early part of World War II. That's understandable. People are feeling particularly patriotic and protective, again, of the flag, very much like they did toward the end of the Civil War. And then a couple of very important cases having to do with the flag, not specifically with flag burning, but more with the Pledge of Allegiance happened in the 1940s. What were those cases?
Sure. Well, there were really two cases. One followed the other. The first one was the Minersville School District case versus Gobetz. And in that case, there was a Pennsylvania school that was requiring students to pledge allegiance to the flag. And a Jehovah's Witness student objected to that. She suggested that that was a violation of her religion.
Right.
And so she filed a lawsuit, and it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, you know, it's not a violation of the Constitution, and if you want to change this requirement that you pledge allegiance to the flag, then, well, do it through democracy. Get someone in the local school board or in your local elected official to change the rule.
Right. So, I mean, just again, to frame it, this is a public school kid going to a public school, so this is the government, through the person of the principal and the teacher, telling this public school student that she had to stand up, place her right hand on her heart, and recite specific words, the Pledge of Allegiance at this point. And so even setting aside the religious issue, and I understand that Jehovah's Witnesses have a religious prohibition of taking oaths and pledges of this sort, but setting aside that, it's compelling her to speak out loud. It's what we call compelled speech. And yet in the Minersville case, the Supreme Court said that was okay, and it said so because this was an important part of building good citizens and protecting our democratic system of government. So not exactly—
It wasn't even a close case, really. I mean, it was an 8-1 decision. And so it's interesting that a couple years later, you know, we have a reversal.
Yeah, complete 180-degree reversal of this. What was that case?
That was a case. So the first case, the Minersville case, was out of Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and in a state right next door, West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett, virtually the exact same case 3 years later, the state adopted a resolution requiring students and teachers to salute the flag and recite the pledge. And if students didn't do it, they would get expelled.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a Jehovah's Witness girl refused to participate and got into some trouble and challenged it, and the case went up to the Supreme Court.
And what did the court do?
Here, the Supreme Court said, you know, it's weird. How can we, on the one hand, under the First Amendment, guard a person's right to speak his or her mind, but on the other hand, we can force a person to say something that they don't think?
Mm-hmm.
And so a real reversal of an approach to forced speech and forced reverence and forced conformity. And in the West Virginia versus Barnett case, the court said, you know, one of the quintessential things, one of the most important things about the free speech clause of the First Amendment is freedom to be different, to be a contrarian, and to not just be different with regard to things that are unimportant, but also to have different opinions with regard to things that are very, very important to society.
Right.
And so really there shouldn't be some proscribed orthodoxy which with regard to politics or nationalism or religion.
In fact, you're referencing one of the most eloquent statements, and I believe the entire Supreme Court canon, penned by one of the most underappreciated Supreme Court justices, Justice Robert Jackson, who had never even gone to law school. He read for the law, and the stories say that he always felt a little bit of envy and irritation and perhaps inferiority compared to some of the other law professor types who were on the Supreme Court then. But he was a better writer than any of them. And he wrote one of my favorite passages in all of Supreme Court judicial opinion history. Do you have a copy of it there in front of you?
I have a copy of, I think, the blurb that you're speaking about.
Right. If there's any fixed star.
If there's any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess their faith therein.
Right. And it even goes on, doesn't it, a little bit from there?
It does. It goes on to talk about why we value the freedom of speech. And what's really interesting is, you know, you often hear this when we're talking about Supreme Court cases. If you go back and you look at the Minersville case, there was one holdout. There was one dissenting opinion. And Justice Stone, in his dissenting opinion, said, you know, the very essence of liberty, the very essence of the free speech clause guarantees that people will be free from compulsion with regard to what they will think and say. And you see that incorporated into the majority opinion 3 years later.
So those two cases, the Minersville case followed 3 years later by the Barnett case, represent a watershed moment for the First Amendment coming into its own, first being denied, free speech being denied, and then being protected, and more or less the same court coming to the opposite conclusion. And we also see a dissent becoming the majority, which is something that happens. That's why Supreme Court justices and other judges write dissenting opinions, sometimes take great pains with them, is because they're hoping that one day a future court will agree with them. And just a very, very inspiring change and turn of events. In fact, it really, really brings home to me something that I've long felt. You know, when you go to a baseball game or you go to some other event where the Star Spangled Banner is sung or where people recite the Pledge of Allegiance, it's so much more meaningful, to me at least, because it's not compelled. We do these things because we love our country. We do these things because we're Americans, because we're proud. It often brings tears to my eyes, and I know it does for many other people. If it were compelled, then what does it mean? You know, that's what authoritarian regimes do. That's what they do in North Korea. They compel people to stand out there and praise the dear leader. We don't do that here. And so our expressions are genuine. That's real free expression.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that to the extent that someone's expressing something, it's truly heartfelt and they believe it. And so I think that there's a value to that.
Yeah, which is taken away if you compel it. So I think the court got it wrong, and then the court got it right a few years later. It's one of my favorite opinions in all of the Supreme Court history. But I think I've made that point. Okay, so what happens next?
So, interestingly, if you go back to even, you know, way back, we were talking about the 1800s at the beginning of the discussion. You know, there's not a lot of evidence historically of flag desecration or burning throughout the 19th and 20th century. It just didn't happen that often. It happened here or there. But really, when flag burning began to take place a lot was the 1960s,
right,
and the Vietnam War era. And in the 1960s, in 1967 in New York City, there was a huge anti-Vietnam War demonstration in New York City. There were pictures taken of the protest where flags were burned. And these pictures were widely publicized. And that very soon led, a year later, to the federal flag desecration law of 1968, which outlawed knowingly casting contempt upon any flag of the United States by defiling it, mutilating it, defacing it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see the flag being treated this way in the 1960s as part of the sort of civil rights movement and the Vietnam War. And so that's where we start to see the development of the modern cases that lead up to Texas versus Johnson, which is the case that protects flag burning. So in 1969, there's a case that comes out of New York where a gentleman was arrested for showing contempt towards the American flag by words, so verbal contempt for the American flag. This was a New York law that he was charged with violating. He did burn a flag, but he also he also directed some negative words towards the American flag. And so
are those radio friendly words? Can you tell me what he said?
Well, what's interesting is he said, we don't need an American flag. We don't need no damn flag. That was it.
Didn't drop the F-bomb or anything of that sort.
No F-bombs or anything like that. And so he's arrested and charged with the New York law. The court said, well, we're not really sure what he was charged with or what he was found guilty of. Was he found guilty of burning the flag or the words he used? And the court said, well, we can't really disentangle those two things. And so to the extent that part of his conviction was for the words he used, the court said, you know, the state cannot punish people for contemptuous words directed at the flag. He wasn't, you know, inciting people to lawlessness. He wasn't trying to encourage people to do something illegal. He was expressing his own opinions about the flag.
Wasn't threatening anybody.
He wasn't threatening anyone. He wasn't directing fighting words at anyone. He wasn't using epithets toward a particular person.
Right.
And, you know, he used the word damn, but other than that, it wasn't sort of words that would shock the conscience. And the court said, you know, way back in the mid 1940s, we said the government can't force people to show proper respect for the flag through the words that they use. They can't force words or prohibit words directed at the flag. So they cited that West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett case to say, you know, the government doesn't have an interest in ensuring people show proper verbal respect to the flag.
All right. So they're starting again to move toward protection of speech in 1969. You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. We're speaking about a fiery topic this week, flag burning. After the break, we'll finish our conversation with our guest, Doug McKechnie, our First Amendment guy.
Perhaps no other president has been as reluctant and ill-prepared for war as was James Madison. Madison had neither the personality nor temperament usually associated with a good wartime leader, and his political philosophy, which so much informed the structure and spirit of the Constitution, was diametrically opposed to a strong and independent executive and a highly armed and organized national military. It was Madison, however, unimposing in stature, quiet and aloof in disposition, cautious and deliberate in thought, ideologically opposed to standing armies and navies, and morally abhorrent of defense as an excuse for unchecked executive power, who led America into its first declared war, the War of 1812. America was thoroughly unprepared for war militarily, economically, and psychologically. With one of America's most bumbling and conniving executive cabinets and a field command which was overaged and incompetent, Madison took America to war against the greatest superpower of that time. The winner? The Constitution. Your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
So President-elect Donald Trump has not let up on his Twitter habit, apparently, and one of his latest tweets is calling for people who burn the American flag to be punished with a year in jail or losing their citizenship. A protester is burning the flag. Is that free speech or hate speech? And
I believe it's covered by the First Amendment. Yes. Even Antonin Scalia said that it was protected. You know, that's what this country is about so far.
And I think that's what's scary is anything that's infringing upon our very constitutional right to speak.
You're a grand old flag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue, where there's never a ghost or brag. But should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our conversation with our First Amendment guy, Doug McKechnie, who teaches constitutional law at the United States Air Force Academy. The big case when it comes to flag burning, of course, is Texas versus Johnson from 1989, but we've been building our way slowly in that direction because although Johnson was the case, there were lots and lots of earlier cases, and I think we're right up to about 1970.
There are two cases in 1974 that were issued in the same term. One is the Smith versus Gogan case, and the other one is the Spence versus Washington case. In Smith versus Gogan, he was charged with treating the flag with contempt. This was a Massachusetts law that prohibited treating the flag with contempt. He wore an American flag on the seat of his pants. There was a patch that he had on the seat of his pants. He didn't challenge this under the First Amendment. He challenged it under the 14th Amendment. And he said, you know, what does it mean to prohibit treating the flag with contempt? That's just a vague law. And I don't know how what actions are illegal and what actions are legal and illegal. And the court said, you know, you're right. This is in the mid-70s. There's lots of people who wear the flag as a shirt or use it in merchandising. And there's just lots of casual and careless and frankly unceremonial treatment of the flag. And so it's unclear what Massachusetts is trying to punish. So the court struck this law down.
That's a really interesting. Think about that for just a moment. Now that man may very well have intended it as a sign of disrespect, because of where he placed, he put on the seat of his pants. Okay, one can understand that could be considered to be disrespectful. On the other hand, I seem to recall on at least one occasion having seen young women wearing swimsuits with bikini bottoms that had American flags on them. And was that disrespectful? Or was it exactly the opposite? Were they showing their patriotism by wearing bikinis with flags on them? I seem to recall young men having had swimming trunks that had flag sort of designs on them. Was that disrespectful? So much of this goes to the intention of the speaker, and one can't necessarily conclude anything simply because of where the patch is or what particular item of apparel is being worn.
And that's what the court said. The court said, you know, it just provides too much leeway, too much subjectivity to law enforcement or even the criminal justice system. You know, are police officers going to be the one who is determine, you know, this is an inappropriate, contemptuous treatment of the flag and this is not? Is that going to be a prosecutor? Is it going to be jury members who sort of, you know, include their own preferences in deciding what's contemptuous treatment? It's just unclear. And so it wasn't struck down under the First Amendment. It was struck down under the 14th Amendment for being too vague.
Right. Yeah. You can't be vague in crimes of that sort or in defining crimes generally, because then people don't know what's illegal and how can they regulate their behavior. Okay.
One more case before we get to Texas versus Johnson, Spence versus Washington, again, in 1974, he was charged with improper use of the flag. He put removable tape on his American flag, and he put sort of Scotch tape. He made this a peace symbol on the flag. There was a Washington law that prohibited superimposing images on a flag.
Okay, so he basically decorated his flag by adding a peace symbol to it.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the court said, again, you know, is this – and this is really one of the first times the court saying, okay, can the American flag itself be used as a means of communication? Perhaps a means of communication that some people may disagree with. And the court said, yes, here he is trying to communicate something. And he even said, you know, I was communicating my disagreement with the war in Cambodia and the Vietnam War and the killings of students at Kent State. And the court said, you know, he's not breaching the peace. There was no evidence that people were in an uproar. You know, maybe some people would be offended, but if you're offended when you look at it, just look away, look the other way. And so, you know, and we can't pass laws to protect the sensibilities of the viewers of this flag. And finally, the court says, all right, well, yes, maybe the government has an interest in preserving the flag as a symbol of the country. And maybe it even has an interest in preserving the physical integrity of the flag. But, you know, this guy didn't destroy the flag because the tape could be removed. And, you know, there was really no chance that anyone would be confused that somehow the government was was articulating this message. The government had, you know, put this peace symbol on this flag. It was this own guy's, it was this guy's flag, and he had it up in his own apartment. And so no one would confuse this as a message coming from the government.
Very interesting. So these cases ever since the Barnett case in the 1940s seem to be pointing all in the same direction, which is that, you know, the free speech clause of the First Amendment is going to protect more or less any behavior directed at the flag. And yet, even in this last case, they were suggesting that maybe that wouldn't include actually destroying the flag. That seems to be the flashpoint, no pun intended, but that people are still sort of shying away from this idea that flag burning would be protected.
Yeah, the court keeps trying, in my opinion, throughout the 60s and 70s, keeps trying to dodge this question of desecration. And so, you know, contemptuous words toward the flag. Well, when the government can't prohibit that, improper use of the flag. Well, you know, if it's not being destroyed, then maybe, you know, that's protected. And so the court keeps kind of trying to sidestep the question of direct mutilation or destruction of the flag.
Right. Okay, but it's still coming down the pike. So after the 1970s cases, we have a few years off, and then we get to 1989, right?
1989, which is Texas versus Johnson. And this is the case that everyone points to when they talk about the fact that the First Amendment protects desecration of the flag.
Okay, so what happened?
Well, in Texas versus Johnson, there was a Texas law that forbade desecrating the U.S. flag when the person who performs the desecration knows that it will offend observers. And so during the Republican National Convention, the defendant, Johnson, was participating in anti-Ronald Reagan demonstrations, anti-Republican demonstrations, and he burned a flag as part of his protests. There were some witnesses. They were offended. No one was injured. No one was threatened. But he was swept up and arrested for burning that flag.
Right. I seem to recall that it was a group of people who were marching down the street, and they came upon a flagpole, a privately owned flagpole, and then someone decided to haul the flag down. And that's when they lit it on fire, and they were chanting, I think it was, "Red, white, and blue, we spit on you." So they did it somewhat ceremoniously, if in a somewhat unplanned way. And then they left it behind and walked down the street. And that's what Johnson was arrested for.
It is. And one of the really interesting things or interesting parts of the story is that after that happened, there was a man who came up upon the flag and collected the remains of the flag and buried it in the suggested ceremonial way to treat a flag that has fallen or has become soiled. He buried the flag, which is what's suggested by the federal code.
Exactly right. And in fact, that really brings up the heart of the question, because as you have said, the Texas statute forbade desecration of the flag. Now, that word is loaded. It means destroying it or in other ways harming it physically with an intention to degrade it in some fashion, to show disrespect, to make it less sacred in some sense. But at the same time, it did not forbid the ceremonial destruction of the flag. And this is a good point to pause and remember, that's exactly how one destroys an old flag. Flags get tattered, flags get stained, flags get old, and it's time to get rid of them. Well, we don't like to throw them in the trash. It doesn't look nice to have a flag in the trash can. It doesn't look nice when the garbage man picks it up and people see it hanging out of the back of a garbage truck. It doesn't look nice when it's in a landfill. It looks disrespectful. And so what do you do with the flag? Well, you can call up your local Boy Scout troop, and your local Boy Scout troop will come and pick it up and will collect a few flags. And then every year or 6 months, they will literally have a flag burning ceremony. And there's a whole way that this is done. I was a Boy Scout. I never actually participated in one of these ceremonies, but there's a whole way it's done. It's done very respectfully. You give your little scout salute and all the rest of it, but you burn the flags up. Because then they're ashes, and then you bury the ashes, and now you don't have flags sticking out of garbage cans. So it's perfectly okay for the Boy Scouts to burn flags because they're doing it with a respectful intention. But it's not okay for somebody like Johnson to come by and spit on the flag or do it in a disrespectful way.
And I think that's exactly one of the things that the court picks up on, is the government interest in prohibiting mistreatment of the flag is directly related to expression. The government in the Johnson case argues if the flag is desecrated, people will think that, you know, the ideas that it embodies don't exist, or that people will have negative sort of feelings associated with the flag. And the court said, you know, the state's concern is only implicated when the flag is mistreated. And the attempt by the government is to prohibit communication or of ideas that the government doesn't like.
Right.
And so that's just foreign. That's a foreign idea to the First Amendment and to the freedom of speech. And so that's a content-based restriction. That's the government suggesting that there is a message that you cannot communicate, that we dislike so much that we're going to punish you for communicating this message, which is unhappiness with American policy, disagreement with American policy. I'm going to express that through desecrating or mistreating the flag.
Exactly. In fact, this is probably the most offensive type of government restriction on speech. It's what we call not only a content-based restriction on speech, but a viewpoint-based restrictions. It's okay to burn a flag if you do it respectfully and you say, I love America. But it's not okay to do exactly the same thing if you say, I don't love America. And that is basically the government approving of the Boy Scouts' viewpoint, but not approving of Mr. Johnson's viewpoint. And that the government may not do.
That's correct. The court said, you know, nothing in the precedents, nothing in Supreme Court case law suggests that the state can force its own idea with regard to the flag on other people. In fact, you go way back to the Barnett case in the 1940s right. that we talked about. You know, the court has, even way back in the mid 20th century, the court was talking about the idea that the government can't force orthodoxy on people. It can't force them to think something about a particular object or a particular idea.
Right. In fact, I think one of the justices suggested that a more appropriate response to this sort of flag burning is not to prohibit the speech, but to have more speech. And then he cited the example of that man that said, you know, basically that's what you do when you see somebody leave the ashes of the flag in a disrespectful way. Then you go and you clean them up and you treat them with respect. You respond to bad speech as you perceive it with good speech as you perceive it. That's the way we protect the First Amendment and the flag at the same time.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, I think it's important to understand that this case was still a close case. This was decided
5-4.
5-4. And the Chief Justice at the time, Justice Rehnquist, suggested that flag burning should be just taken out of First Amendment protection. There are some categories of speech that are wholly unprotected by the First Amendment. And he said flag burning should be one of them. He said it is so incredibly offensive, and there's really no part of the robust discussion that we protect under the First Amendment that's furthered by burning a flag. It offends so many people, it really just serves to antagonize, and it should just be totally unprotected speech. So it is important to understand that it was a close decision.
Very, very close decision. In fact, I note, and I often mention Justice Rehnquist's dissent in that particular case, because he calls it, I think, an inarticulate howl.
He says, grunt or a roar.
Right, a grunt or a roar. He says flag burning is low-value speech. It's just a grunt or a roar. It's not worth protecting, especially given the enormous offense that it causes. So he was going to make a categorical exemption and simply say flag burning is just one of those categorical exemptions. But the problem with every categorical exemption, whether it's for obscenity or whether it's for threatening speech or whatever it is, it's always definitional. So, okay, if you can't desecrate the American flag, what exactly does that mean? And, you know, does it apply not just to the flag, but to other red, white, and blue symbols? Or what about the Great Seal of the United States with the eagle and all the rest of it? You know, where does the protection begin and end? Where does the exemption begin and end? So if Justice Rehnquist's dissent were to be adopted, that would not end the controversy. It would create more controversy.
No, I think you're right. And in fact, the 1968 federal flag desecration law prohibited showing contempt or desecrating any flag of the United States. So would that mean a flag from the 40s or the 30s? Would that mean
the Betsy Ross flag? Exactly. Yeah.
A flag of a branch of the military? I mean, it could mean anything.
It could mean lots and lots of things. You also mentioned that it was a 5-4 decision. You know, it came down to one vote, and one of the votes in favor of protecting speech, that is on the winning side, was by a justice whom our president-elect has declared as his model for Supreme Court justices, and it's none other than Justice Scalia.
Justice Scalia voted with the majority in both Texas versus Johnson and then a case that followed it the next year, U.S. versus Eichmann, which is another case to sort of clean up the Texas versus Johnson case. But Justice Scalia was a stalwart in protecting the freedom of speech through desecrating the flag.
Yeah, I think that was one of the votes of Justice Scalia's that I most admired. And it doesn't mean I always agree with him or always disagree with him. It's just that I think I understand that it was very hard for him to vote that way because he doesn't like flag desecration. He doesn't sympathize with Mr. Johnson's viewpoint, and yet he had to go in there and bite the bullet and say, but nonetheless, I'm going to protect that speech.
Justice Scalia is famous for a quote that he articulated where he said, you know, if I was king, I would outlaw flag desecration. But we don't have a king, and I'm not the king. We have a constitution, and it protects free speech. And so, you know, I think that was he played a pivotal role in protecting free speech through burning the flag or desecrating the flag. And, you know, there's really only one justice left on the court now that was on the court when this decision came down, and that's Justice Kennedy. But I think the reality is almost every justice on the court now would probably uphold that case from the 1980s, Texas versus Johnson. Maybe Justice Alito would be a holdout, but the Roberts Court has been
very speech protective.
Yeah. Very speech protective. And I think it's cited the Texas versus Johnson case in a case from 2014 where it talks about protecting free speech.
Yeah, I think that it's become well-settled law, and I think that people have had a chance to voice their reactions to it. In fact, I think a number of times there have been constitutional amendments introduced in either the House or the Senate that have not gone anywhere to actually exempt the flag or to prohibit flag burning, I should say. It's never gone anywhere because I think ultimately when people think about it, they realize that the court did come to the right decision in Texas versus Johnson. As unpalatable as that is for most of us, it really does protect our free speech rights. There's a great anecdote. I'm not sure if it's apocryphal or now, but that on the morning after the Texas versus Johnson case was announced in the press, that Justice Scalia came down to breakfast and was a little bit nervous about his wife hearing about his vote in that case. And apparently the story goes that she didn't say anything to him as she cooked his breakfast, but simply started humming, "You're a grand old flag." I don't know if that's true, but it's a great story, isn't it? Okay, so that's the big case, Texas versus Johnson. So to bring it back to the present day, it's very well accepted and unlikely to be overturned either by the Supreme Court or by constitutional amendment that the government cannot punish us for burning the flag. So there really doesn't seem to be any constitutional basis at all for the president-elect's tweet on that subject, does there?
I don't think so. I think, though, it's still important to understand how we got to where we're at and why we got there. So it's important to know the easy answer, no, you can't be put in jail for burning the flag. But the why, I think, is also important. And what's the value in that protection?
Exactly right. Well, Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy, thank you so very much for giving us all this very interesting background on the First Amendment about protecting the flag or desecrating the flag, as the case may be. We certainly appreciate learning about it. And you've got your disclaimer you've got to give again, right?
My views are my own and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the United States government.
Thanks, Doug.
Thanks, Stuart.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to our First Amendment guy, Doug McKechnie of the U.S. Air Force Academy, who is always so erudite and enlightening. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. And my name is Stuart Harris. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.